This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will often select at random. Any book from my comic collection is eligible as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 153rd episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we're looking at the Thor Annual number 6 from Marvel Comics, cover dated 1977. But first, a little feedback. First, back from the Archie issue covered on episode 151, John from Married with Comics said that the book brought back some great memories. Archie books were the majority of my comics reading as a young kid because both of my parents read them and were more likely to consent to buying one as opposed to a superhero book. Even after I got older, I would buy Archie Digests every now and then. I think I'll read a few now. You should, John, especially if you can get them for cheap. But that's always my rule. For everything. In episode 152, we talked about the JSA and Power Girl. Billy D. from Into the Weird said it was a good episode and that he enjoyed hearing that I've become a breaker of my own rules. Rob Myers, the Robin guy, was shocked at my behavior. The professor breaking the rules for shame. Sorry to disappoint you, Rob. Jeremiah Jones Goldstein, the notorious JJG, was intrigued by the episode announcement, wondering which rule I broke. I'm looking forward to all my questions being answered. Well, I hope that works out, Jeremiah. Podcasting's Michael Bailey, the brains behind this year's JL May. Look, I know Shag is on a lot of the episodes, but come on. Obviously, he's not the... Well, anyway, Michael is the brains behind the operation. And of course, JL May is still going on, and he wrote in about that issue with an interesting theory. Professor, you are a sneaky devil, sir. You play the trailer for this year's JL May and take part in it, but never say that this is what you're doing on the Quarter Bin. You trusted us, the audience, to connect those dots. This is next level hosting. Good job. He doesn't add or next level trolling, but he continues that maybe I didn't know that the Power Girl JSA classified miniseries was released in the lead-up to Infinite Crisis. Or maybe you did know it, but didn't want to mention it. In any case, I salute you. The truth is, Podcastings, I learned that fact during the process of putting my notes together. And of course, the first thing I did was scrambled to the Mega JL May database to see if it was being covered by someone else during the event. But no, because I guess, depending on the definition, it was not technically a Countdown to Infinite Crisis book. Otherwise, the brains behind the JL May operation would have put it on the list. I think I'm in the clear here. This was more like a book from the event before the event, before the event. Now, all kidding aside, Michael did continue, good choice for an episode subject. I have an affection for Power Girl that stretches back decades, and I was definitely excited for this series when it came out. Better than that, I was satisfied with the series. Johns could do no wrong with me at the time, but even in my recent reread, I couldn't find much fault in the series. Except one thing. Martha Kent seemed a bit hard on Kara. I get where she was coming from, and I realized she wasn't trying to be mean, but that didn't feel like the Martha I see in my head. Other than that, the series was aces. Thanks for another great episode, as always. I look forward to the next one. Regards, Podcasting's Michael Bailey. Yeah, that's a tough scene with Martha. His Power Girl's reaction was definitely to be very, very sad. But judging from just what we have of that scene itself, I don't think Martha did anything that was too far out of line. It was just a tough situation that was going to end with Kara being sad, being discouraged, being depressed. Now, referencing a certain feature on Power Girl's outfit, on the cover of that issue, Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond said that he thought the episode would offer listeners a window into my comic book insights. David Ace Gutierrez, formerly of the Ultraverse Network, asked the rhetorical question of which of my origins people preferred, the Atlantean one or me as a Kryptonian raised by Latverian parents. And Sir Martin of Grey from the excellent blog, Too Dangerous for a Girl, wrote in as well. First, he noted that that episode came out the day that longtime comics pro Martin Pasco passed away. And he said that this provided much needed cheer on a sad day for comics. Thank you, Martin. And then later, he added that there was something weird about the cover. The eyes make Power Girl look possessed, and the chest is too in your face, like a parody bosom. Agreed on both counts. I do think that Power Girl's bosom is often used for comedic effect. And the eyes, they are strangely drawn and angled. That is true, Mark. I went more for an interpretation of intense rather than possessed, but I do get where you're coming from. In terms of the musical discussion, he added, oh, and on the music front, if we're after classical, how about The Sea for Aquaman, Ride of the Valkyries for, you know, Valkyrie? Or perhaps other listeners have suggestions. Good thoughts, Mart. I do think that I will try to be a little more creative in my searches for music to play during episodes. I'm not promising noticeable changes, but I will take all of this under advisement. And you may remember that in that episode, I called on Dr. Ange of the Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, for his thoughts on Power Girl and her similarities and differences to Supergirl. I was curious how a mega fan of one of the characters felt about the other of the characters. Were they considered rivals? Were they considered equivalents? Were they considered friends or cousins? And boy, oh boy, did Dr. Ange answer my questions. He answered all of my questions. No, I think he answered all of the possible questions. Buckle in. Thanks so much for covering JSA Classified Number 1, an arc I love because it reestablished Karen as a Kryptonian. This was Geoff Johns' way of reclaiming much of the good of DC history, which had been cast aside. Given the recent rebirth, and even in some ways Doomsday Clock, this seems to be Johns' lot in life. He has to remind the powers that be at DC what actually works for their IP. Having a multiverse, having a concept of legacy, and establishing Superman as a beacon of hope and inspiration. As for Power Girl and Supergirl, it is an interesting conversation. I do consider myself a Power Girl fan. I love her can-do attitude, her brashness, even her superhero dealing with the BS of everyday life, more recent stories. She is, in many ways, not Supergirl, but the She-Hulk of the DC Universe. And for that, I love her. Doctor, that is an excellent diagnosis. That is the comparison to She-Hulk. If you look in my collection, Ange continues, you'll see swaths of All-Star Comics, JSA All-Stars, New 52 World's Finest, and Power Girl issues, all because of my love for Karen. but as a Supergirl fan, do I consider her the Earth 2 Supergirl, if you will? No. I consider her a different character. I've been running a Supergirl fan blog for a dozen years, and I only have a smattering of Power Girl posts, and most of those are crossovers with Supergirl. Is she Kara Zor-El, rocketed from Krypton? Yes. Is she Kryptonian? Yep. But she's older than Kara. She showed up when she's a young adult, not a young teenager. And she seems to already be an established person and a hero, and that makes her different from Supergirl. And that's why the difference in name is so important. She isn't Supergirl. She's Power Girl. Why do I love Supergirl? First, let me say what I think of as the sort of platonic ideal, perfect Kara Zor-El. She's young, and as such, she's optimistic and bright. She sees the best in people. She has gone through a lot for her young age, but she also wants to help people so no one has to go through what she has. She can be fierce in her battle against injustice, but because she is young, she's still learning. She can be brash too. She can sometimes think with her fists initially. And she can lose. And, oh yeah, she feels the weight of that S-shield and all it represents. She knows she's Superman's cousin and knows all the expectations that that brings. As I've said many times, I love Superman and am inspired by him, but I can't be Superman. He's too pure and I'm too human. So I'm really inspired by Supergirl. She, like me, wants to be like Superman, but she can stumble along the way. And when she slips or fails or is too brash, she can be emotionally bruised. She sometimes struggles to dust herself off and get back in there, something I can also relate to. So given that, Ange continues, where does Power Girl fit in exactly? Well, she's older, more confident, a bit cynical. She has learned from Superman for sure, but she doesn't need his approval. She doesn't need his symbol. She can yell at a misogynistic wildcat. She can roll her eyes at leering men. She can lead the new JSA. I love all that. I love powerful female heroes. But those characteristics of Karen aren't the same things that draw me to Kara. I do like that in more than one incarnation, Power Girl sort of laments not being Superman's cousin. There would be that touch of greatness, that legacy, sure. But I also think that Supergirl and her status carry some baggage that Karen would need to shrug off. Because again, she is her own person. Few things excellent were spawned from the New 52, but one thing I liked was the world's finest duo of Huntress and Power Girl. They were actually the Robin and Supergirl of Earth 2, respectively. The PG in that series was fascinating. We saw flashbacks on Earth 2, where she seemed very much in the mold of a Silver Age Supergirl, right down to that innocence and optimism. In many ways, she felt like a true Supergirl, so much so that I covered that series on my blog. But once again, the age difference, and perhaps the independence born from her being in her 20s and basically living on her own on this new world, made her again much more of a standalone Power Girl than a second Supergirl. That's an awesome point, Ange, and I have to say, I liked some bits of the New 52 and really liked that World's Finest series. Right on target there. I suppose, Ange said, sort of wrapping up, if you look at the Venn diagram of Supergirl fans and Power Girl fans, there would probably be a big overlap. I don't think the two fandoms feel that they're battling for who is the real Kara. But I bet if you ask those fans what they like about each of the characters, like me, they'd probably have different lists. Hope you read the rest of JSA Classified. I plan to. And remember that I'm always here to talk about the Girl of Steel. Ange, thank you, Doctor. I think you've done enough talking for now, okay? No, seriously, I do appreciate the detail in that response. I was sincerely curious about those issues, how those two characters were viewed by a mega super fan of one of those characters. So thanks for answering all of those questions. Social media love for last episode came from David Ace Gutierrez, Gene Hendricks from the Class 1000 RPG podcast, Pat from the Long Box Crusade, Al Sedano, Derek William Crabb from the Fanholes, Bill Beer from the Batpod, Jerry from Professor Frenzy, It's a Show, Mike Peacock, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Max Traver, James Williams, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Fan Film Fridays, Chris Lydon, Marvel Fan 76, Kyle Benning, Dave Walker, Tim Price, the Podcrasher, the Collected Edition Podcast, Laurel Mountain Flower from the Huntress Podcast, Old School Ross, and our listeners of the year, the Sutherlands, from the Rad Adventures Network. Let's take a break here, play a promo for a podcast, and when we get back, let's take a look at Thor Annual number 6.
Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast, a new monthly show chronicling the adventures of the JLI era by Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis, will be going issue by issue, in release order, tackling the core Justice League title, Justice League Europe, and the quarterly book. Along the way, we'll take time out for special episodes covering various spin-offs, cartoon appearances, the infamous TV pilot, and much more. So join me in an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we celebrate your favorite JLI members, such as
Martian Manhunter,
Batman,
Dr. Fate,
Black Canary,
Fire,
Ice,
Maxwell Lord,
Oberon,
Captain Marvel,
Rocket Red,
Captain Atom,
Mr. Miracle,
Guy Gardner,
Booster Gold,
Blue Beetle,
Nort,
and many, many more. Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast, coming March 2016 as part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Want to make something of it?
And we're back. Thor, annual number 6 at a cover price of 50 cents, meaning that you would guess that I acquired this book at a very easy-to-compute 50% sale price. But, and you're probably getting used to this by now, here's the thing. Remember about 8 to 10 episodes ago I talked about possibly changing the quarter bin criteria for coverage on my show, and we came up with a bunch of potential options on how to go about that? And you may recall, that was a very non-controversial episode, calm, reasoned discussion. Everybody was 100% in total agreement with the plan. I recall unanimous support. Or maybe not. Well, anyway, our plan, which we've done for the last 2 episodes and this one and maybe the next 3 or 4, with the possible interruption of Free Comic Book Day, should that indeed happen at some point this summer, we're going to break our long-standing rules for the podcast, and in each episode, we're going to do that rule-breaking in a different way. So for this one, we're breaking the rule of not covering comics that lovely listeners have given to me over the years. The reason was that even though, technically speaking, obviously, I didn't pay for any of the books that were given to me, that's kind of the definition of a gift. But the point of this show is to talk about books that you can find in cheap bins, those diamonds in the rough. And people sending me books, which I appreciate. I love the hashtag comic book circle of life. One of the reasons I started the Comics Reading Journal podcast was to talk about the books sent in to me by lovely listeners. But I felt that that does kind of circumvent at least the spirit of the show, which is books that I found in the wild for cheap. But since this is the rule-breaking series of episodes, I figured it was time to break that rule too. So I went through the stack, grabbed 10 random standalone stories that folks had given me over the years, and the randomizer landed on this one. Thor Annual number 6, sent in by Billy D., a.k.a. Doc Strange on Twitter, from the Magazines and Monsters blog and the Into the Weird podcast. Thank you, Billy. The cover of Thor Annual number 6 by John Buscema and Joe Sinnott shows Thor front and center. We're told that this is a king-sized annual, double-length dynamite from Mighty Marvel. Behind the Thunder God stand about a dozen other characters smaller in size. Cover copy tells us who these folk are, in case someone eyeing this on a newsstand or a spinner rack didn't know. Side by side with the Guardians of the Galaxy versus Korvac and his minions of menace. And the cover's okay. It is quite cluttered. Lots of words and lots of characters, but it's all about generating excitement for this overstuffed book. So I think I understand that impulse to overstuff and overclutter the cover. The story, Thunder in the 30th Century, was written by Len Wein and Roger Stern, with art by Sal Buscema and Klaus Janson. This is a double-sized annual, as we said, so this will either be a really long synopsis, or it will be a synopsis that skips a lot of stuff. We'll have to wait and see, but just so you know, you've been warned. We start in Midtown Manhattan, where the usually jaded citizens turn their collective gaze skyward, staring in unashamed awe at the majestic, golden-haired figure hurtling by high overhead. That's Thor, of course, and his attention is captured by activity in front of Roxxon Nucleonics. The authorities doth lay siege to yonder building. Clearly mine aid be needed there. One of the police officers alerts him that half a dozen terrorists are bottled inside with an active nuclear reactor. Thor confronts the terrorists, informing the foolish ones that Thor doth say nay. The Thunder God says that they might even have noble intentions, but that they demean it by their cowardly actions. Verily, permitting their actions no longer. Our hero rather easily defeats them. But a stray bullet shot must have hit the reactor. It's gonna blow. Pray there doth be some way to stop it, knave, or surely Hela shall claim us all. The reactor explodes with a THAKOOM! But when the police burst in, where's that blasted long-haired Avenger gone to? Because all that's left is a smoky hole in the floor. And even as the stupefied police captain stares at the smoldering hole in the lab, the mighty Thor blinks back into reality. But it's the reality of the 30th century. And he has landed inside Korvac's ship. Korvac uses his machines to attack Thor, but Thor fights back. But with the press of a button, Korvac teleports our hero into deep space, where the long-haired adventurer feels the frigid darkness rushing in on him. And everything swiftly turns to black. We then begin Chapter 2 with these five, each the last of their kind. Charlie 27, Martin X the Crystal Man, Flame-haired Nikki, Yondu of Alpha Centauri, and Major Vance Astro, all led by the enigmatic Starhawk. And they shall be the guardians of the galaxy. And they're just flying around in their ship, Freedom's Liberty, really minding their own business, unprepared for the sizzling power beam that suddenly strikes out at their ship. They struggle to make repairs and maintain control, and plan to follow the attack beam to its source, despite Korvac creating a meteor storm for the team to contend with. Starhawk hurtles through the void to clear a path for the ship, and he finds... What? An ice-encrusted humanoid? Incredible! The being still lives. The being is brought back into Freedom's Liberty and eventually thawed. Vance Astro recognizes the guy from when he was a boy. This is Thor, the God of Thunder. We then begin Chapter 3, The Master Plan of Korvac. And first we get his origin, as well as an explanation of his plan. Korvac used to be a computer techno, a dude named Ben, working for the Badoons. One day he collapsed at work from sheer exertion. As punishment, they altered my central nervous system and grafted my body onto a special systems module. In short, I became a living computer. This made Korvac powerful enough to escape his masters. He was then pulled into a contest of champions by the Grandmaster and went up against Doctor Strange, as seen in Giant Size Defenders number 3. Korvac allowed Strange to beat him, siphoning a portion of Grandmaster's powers. He was eventually returned to his proper era by Grandmaster after the game ended, and Korvac learned that he had gained a new power, the power of teleportation. He then created his base and collected his minions. His plan now is to cause Earth's sun to go nova so that he can absorb all that energy into himself. The pitiful little solar system that once ignored me will provide me with power for untold millennia. Which, if you think about it, is just good villain science. He then points to Chekhov's countdown clock, noting that this power becomes his in just 2 hours. That is why there must be no interference. After coming to believe that Thor is in fact who he appears to be, they all figure out that Korvac is a threat and decide to confront him, without knowing the full details of his plan. Which brings us to our final chapter, Chapter 4, This Battleground Paradise. On Korvac's world, our heroes are immediately confronted by his minions, meaning it's time to split the party. Most of the team stay to battle the minions, while our two most powerful folk, Thor and Starhawk, decide to go after Korvac himself. Starhawk figures out where the power beam is coming from. Then 'tis there we shall strike. But every time they get close, they get teleported away, which just keeps frustrating Thor. For the golden gates of Asgard, yon device will bedevil us no more. Starhawk has noticed that Korvac is actually using a machine to teleport and tells Thor how to destroy it, and they confront Korvac one more time. Korvac puts up a stasis field barrier, but Nighthawk busts right through it. Korvac then attacks them with energy beams, which are absorbed by Thor's hammer. And after declaring that he will not let them destroy this paradise, Korvac fires a neural beam from his eye socket that forces Thor and Starhawk to fight each other because team up comic. While the other Guardians are beating on Korvac's minions, our two powerhouses realize that they really have to fight each other hard, go all out, increase the battle of force until we destroy the Citadel. Even though it might mean Starhawk's death, they have to do it. And they enter into a battle between man-like god and god-like man, with no quarter given, no holds barred. Their battle is the stuff of legends, the sort of battle which literally brings down the house, Korvac teleporting away just as his fortress collapses. And with the countdown hitting 1 minute, this lifts the spell, and Thor hammers at the power beam machine. This infernal device must cease to be. In the aftermath of battle, Starhawk uses Korvac's machine to teleport Thor back to his proper time, and he reunites with his team. Fare you well, Thor. We shall meet again. And back in the 20th century, as the officers cross the room to inspect the hole left by Thor's disappearance, famp, he returns. If I told thee where I was, Captain, thou wouldst not believe it. Out into the night strides the God of Thunder, and for a long time he stares off into the star-flecked firmament, his heart aglow with memories of comrades yet to come. Fare thee well, guardians. Aye, fare thee well. The end. So, as Trennis Magnus likes to ask, what did I think of this? Well, let's start by discussing the concept of annuals, which over the history of comic books have come in a variety of shapes and sizes, let us say. You've got the reprint annuals. You've got the major, important, big-deal event annuals, think wedding, that sort of thing. Company-wide crossovers. Or just company-wide themes. And you've also got extra-sized, one-off, standalone stories. And that category includes one of the all-time great comic books, and I mean that. Fantastic Four Annual Number 2, The Origin of Doctor Doom. And that is the category that this falls into. The big standalone story that may or may not be fun, may or may not be good, but most of all, does no harm. By that I mean there's no continuity effect of this issue, of this story. As a matter of fact, in the modern day, like the present of the world, how much time passes in this issue? Maybe 10 minutes? And there's no important action, in terms of the Thor continuity at least, that happened, you know, right leading into this issue, or there's nothing that happens during this issue that will affect the future. And a big reason for that approach to annuals, to the telling of a story with no consequences, is that not everybody who reads the ongoing reads the annuals as well. It's possible back then, because of the increased price, that annuals would be less attractive for newsstands to even carry. Again, because of that higher price point. So back then, back in this era, back in the 70s, readers of an ongoing series may very well have never even seen the annual in the wild. And even in modern collecting, I know there are debates about whether annuals count, quote-unquote, as part of a title if you're trying to accumulate a complete run, or do they count as a separate title altogether? For me, annuals count as part of the run, so a complete collection would need to include them. But that is just me. I mean, that is a legitimate debate among collectors. And obviously, one of the main purposes of this type of annual, at least this annual specifically, I suppose, is to give a platform for some lesser-known characters, both the Guardians and Korvac. For context, the Korvac saga in Avengers is just about a year away. And I think this Thor annual may have been just his second appearance. So this did give readers another chance to get to know him before that big storyline. Similar, getting readers acquainted with the Guardians, getting the Guardians in front of a bigger audience, or at least a different audience. I suppose that was also a major purpose of this annual. Now, the issue itself, the story itself, it's okay. I was a little confused about certain plot points, like the whole nuclear power stuff, starting with having a reactor in a downtown office complex. But maybe that's just 1970s comics for you. More importantly, how did that explosion send him 1,000 years into the future and directly into Korvac's ship? Now, I give Bill Mantlo credit for this. He doesn't even try to explain how that happened. He just presents it, and presents it confidently, telling us that this is what happened. It just happened because comics. And if you're going to do a story in one title that's sort of a backdoor pilot, or at least a showcase for another character or team, this isn't a terrible way to do it. Sometimes you just need a Deus Ex transportation. But again, that coincidence, that lands him in Korvac's ship, that's huge. And I can forgive coincidence as a setup to a story, which is what this is. That actually bothers me much less than using coincidence as a story resolution. I have fewer problems with coincidence at the start of a story than at the end of a story. I'm not totally sure that makes sense. But the ending in this issue more or less worked for me, given the wild setup, the wild, crazy nature of the story. It's a classic case of a tale where the toys are taken out and played with, and then put right back where they belong at the end of the story, no harm, no foul. Now, I'm not a continuity freak, and I don't need every story to be important or to matter. So telling a self-contained 40-page adventure that has very few, if any, consequences for the character, I don't have a problem with that. Now, to be clear, I don't have a problem with comics that do have literary aspirations, that try to be important to say something. But I don't think that every comic has to have that aim. Sometimes I just want to be entertained. Sometimes I want a comic book that doesn't pretend to be anything but. And that's what this comic is. A few more detailed comments on the story. First, as a longtime reader and fan of the Legion of Superheroes, couldn't Marvel have put the Guardians somewhere other than the 30th century? I mean, come on. 1,000 years in the future is Legion territory. Give the Marvel characters their own future century. Not the 24-and-a-half century either. That's Duck Dodgers. But, I don't know, 700 years in the future? 1,200? Just pick your own time frame and don't trespass on someone else's. That's all I'm saying. And I really dug Korvac's minions, although they weren't called that in the body of the story. That was on the cover, though. I like the lizard guy, who I think is Teju, and the yellow dwarf, Grot. There was a little humorous bit about the dwarf guy that happened during the fight scenes. It was one bit of levity in the story. And they were a varied group, and that's what I look for in aliens, that, you know, they're really kind of alien-looking. Now, here towards the end, I do want to talk for a minute or two about the comment that Thor makes talking to the anti-nuke activists who've taken over that Roxxon location. They are clearly in the legal wrong there, and their actions are endangering millions, one of the police officers says. We don't get them out fast, and we can kiss this city goodbye. So they have big, bad plans. And it's these guys' weapons, a stray bullet of theirs, that hits the reactor device. So they are presented as bad guys. They're the instigators, and the cause of all this trouble. But Thor says to them, churls, however noble might be thy cause, thou dost demean it by thy cowardly actions. And I find that an interesting bit of political commentary, because it's pretty balanced. These guys are in the wrong, we get that by their actions, but Thor recognizes that there's a chance their cause may be noble. He doesn't say that it's noble, he doesn't come out and give that judgment, but he recognizes that they certainly see it that way. But he points out that any noble cause can be made ignoble by ignoble actions. It's a nice bit of nuance. Neither side of the nuclear debate being presented as the side of the angels, and neither being demonized either. And the nice thing about that is that you can read that from any side of the debate, any side of the issue, and not feel attacked or triggered or insulted or mocked, or disregarded. Even if you think you can deduce where the comic book is coming from, and you're on the other side, I think you'd probably feel that your view is presented, maybe even respected, because more than one side is. Yes, of course, comic books have always been political, in the sense of discussing current issues, current events. To deny that is to deny history and reality. But they haven't always been partisan, divisive, demonizing, insulting. To deny that is also to deny history and reality. And sometimes, just sometimes, a little thing, an almost throwaway line like that, can really have an effect on my view of the comic and on my verdict. The verdict on Thor Annual 6, it's fine. It's not earth-shaking, and it's not the greatest representation of Thor ever. But if you don't mind an inconsequential one-off, and I don't, it works pretty well. I'd certainly recommend this for a Guardians of the Galaxy completionist, or an Avengers fan who wants background for the Korvac saga. Because in those contexts, it's very good. And it's long enough to be a good deal for a quarter. And since this was given to me by Billy D, it's a steal. Just to clarify, I didn't steal it. Really, he gave it to me free and clear. That wraps up my coverage of Thor Annual number 6, bringing episode 153 to a close. Next time, we're breaking another rule by looking at a story in a collection that could easily be checked out for free from many a public library. And I happened to have recently grabbed a collection featuring this same title character. So we're jumping 40 years into the future by looking at The Mighty Thor number 20, cover dated August 2017. If you have any questions or comments about this issue or the episode, or about annuals, or how you feel about me breaking my rules, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Professor!